I'm Jim Meadows filling in for Celeste Quinn, and the topic during this hour of the Afternoon Magazine are four seminal figures of the folk music revival of the early 1960s. Writer David Haidu has written a new book, Positively Fourth Street, The Lives and Times of Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Mimi Baez Ferreña, and Richard Ferreña. And David Haidu, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jim.
One question that comes to me is, what attracted you to this particular subject, this time of the early 1960s and these four people?
Well, I wanted to do something on the prominent music of the second half of the century, because I had given about 11 years of my life to studying the music, prominent music of the first half of the century, for my first book, which was Lush Life, a biography of Billy Strayhorn that explored the jazz world through the collaboration between Billy Strayhorn and his mentor Duke Ellington, a towering figure of music through the course of the whole century, of course. And when I wanted to turn to the next wave of music. And that led me inevitably to this period when that music grew up, and when a variety of cultural threads and phenomena came together in the early 60s to make rock and roll something more than the ritualistic dance music for teenagers that it started out as. And then that led me to the people in turn. So the two books are kind of bookends or parallels in the views of two different musical worlds and two different cultures through intertwined lives.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that this is, you're talking there for a moment about rock and roll, but we're dealing here with the folk music revival of the early 1960s. The musics aren't totally unseparated from each other. But they certainly are different camps in a lot of ways.
Well, they are today. I was just reading this morning's paper about the "O Brother, Where Art Thou" tour of old time music. There was just a performance in Carnegie Hall, I guess, two nights ago, that was reviewed in today's New York Times. The Times was marveling at how this old time music that's thought of as having a very small audience was now getting national exposure, and my God, even having the stage at Carnegie Hall. But there was a time in the late 1950s and the early 60s when folk music was popular music. It was the most popular music in the country. Just like there was a very brief time in the 40s when jazz was popular music. In the early 60s, no other genre of music was more popular than folk and more of a cultural influence than folk. Joan Baez was on the cover of Time magazine, and at a time when that really conferred something, it really conferred the kind of legitimacy. And she was there not just as an individual, but as a leader of a movement, a cultural and musical movement. There were, in 1963, there were over 300 folk albums released in 1 year. There were dozens upon dozens of folk music magazines. They would all be gone within a year or two, every single one. There was a folk music TV show. There were folk music movies. There were folk singer paper dolls. There was a Hootenanny candy bar in 1963. So, and rock and roll had waned. After its first few years of glory, most of the original founders had disappeared, and scandals or for other reasons. I mean, Elvis was in the army. Jerry Lee Lewis was involved in this terrible sex scandal. Little Richard joined the ministry. Chuck Berry was in prison for tax charge, and as well as had caught up in problems with the Mann Act. And the record industry was making a kind of watered down rock and roll with pop stars like Fabian. And folk music came in to fill a void. But am I ranting? there's a little bit more to the importance of folk music than just its popularity. It also represented something that was antithetical to the prevailing culture at the time, and I think that's the reason that the post-war generation embraced it. It was something radical then, which is forgotten today.
I want to get into that in just a moment, but first I want to introduce our first character, as it were, although of course we're talking about very real people and their lives. Joan Baez, this is a piece of a cut from her first recording, and from your book, I gather it was one of the first pieces that she started performing, an old English ballad.
Don't sing love songs, you'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here, right by my side, and in her right hand, a silver dagger. She says that I can't be your bride. Tell you wicked love in lies. The very next evening they'll court another, leave you alone to pine and sigh. My daddy, a chain 5 miles long, and on every link a heart does dangle of another maid he's loved and wronged.
Joan Baez, that's the old English ballad Silver Dagger. It's, you know, one thing I've noticed in listening to that, that's a beautifully told story, that sort of story construction that I think country western songwriters hope to come up with.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It, if you listen to it now, it's striking about how it seems to have nothing in common with popular music of the day. And it's breathtaking to think that that kind of music was just permeated the culture at one time. Joan had 4 of the top 10 best-selling albums in the Billboard charts with music like that.
Now,
Silver Dagger, beautiful but mournful, tragic song about death.
Why? You were talking about the folk music revival being about something larger than the music at that time. And why would tragic old English ballads, in the case of Joan Baez, carry that sort of weight?
Well, I think the tragedy of the music and the sadness of it and the seriousness of it was part of its appeal to the post-war generation. It was beginning to take the world very seriously and felt that it had reason to, with the rise of the Cold War, the threat of the atomic bomb, the draft looming as a very personal issue for most of them, and also the civil rights movement catching fire. I mean, these were very serious times, and the times that affected, you know, young people closely. And here, there's something about the gravity of this music, the feeling of pending doom, and maybe even a sense of victimhood that I think struck a chord with the post-war, with young people in the post-war era. I think there's some other elements to the Joan's aesthetic and to the aesthetic of folk music that I think also made it a powerful antidote to the times, the young people, too. And if you listen to that recording, it's a young woman with a guitar, finger-picking. There's one instrument and a voice. It's very simple, you know, and very small at a time when everything bigger was supposed to be better, you know, or new was supposed to be improved. Here's an old song. It's a child ballad. It goes back the roots of that song go back centuries. Here's a challenge to the very idea that something new is better. Well, here's something old, you know, and we think it's better, young people were saying.
And Joan Baez was, well, she was 19, I believe, when her first album came out. Do you think that, or does Joan Baez think today that she was aware of the weight of her, I guess, iconhood that was coming across her at the time?
She became aware of it fairly quickly, and it terrified her. It's interesting you should make this point, because one of the reasons I wrote the book was to remind contemporary readers about Joan's significance at the time. She was a towering figure in her time, and it was shortly after she started to become famous, she left the Northeast and moved into a little cabin in Carmel. I interviewed a radio disc jockey who wanted to do an interview with Joan at the Newport Folk Festival, and he went up to her and started asking her some questions, and the woman said to her, you know, I'm not Joan Baez. And he looked a little more closely and said, oh, my God, it's not. It's just another girl, young woman, who's dressed exactly like her, looks exactly like her. And he looked around and he said there were Joan Baezes everywhere. I mean, her influence was such. She came as quite a shock, and she moved to Carmel, to the Carmel Highlands, in a little one-room cabin, and retreated, took stock, and soon moved Dylan out there, actually.
Well, maybe that's the time to introduce our second character, so to speak, in this drama, and that is Bob Dylan. And I'll do that with another piece of music. One of his early, as the early protest songs of Bob Dylan. And this is about a couple of minutes of Masters of War.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain.
Bob Dylan, Masters of War. It's actually using the melody of an old traditional song, which I understand, I think from your book and other places, that he did fairly frequently in his first efforts at songwriting.
Yeah, Bob drew a great deal of inspiration from Woody Guthrie. And Woody Guthrie said, without shame, that he never wrote a melody in his life, that he used the folk tradition. He drawled upon the folk tradition to compose, which is to use existing melodies and chord changes and to adapt them and with original lyrics and to change them, you know. But and for a brief period, just a, you know, little, not much more than a year or so, when Dylan first began composing, he worked out of that tradition. That tune comes at us from a song called Nottingham Town, an English song that he originally learned, Dylan learned, during a trip to England when he heard Bob Davenport sing it. He's a friend of Martin Carthy's. And then Dylan went on to adapt it as anti-war anthem, but you could, that song is a perfect window into Dylan's significance and Dylan's originality, actually, because it's not, what he did is not so much plagiarism as transmutation, and it points to his larger, puts to the essence of his significance. That song, I mean, you could, if close your eyes, and you could almost hear that as a heavy metal song. The contrast between Dylan's approach and Joan's could not be more dramatic. She's attracted to music that's serious, but also delicate. It's a kind of folk chamber music, and Dylan is attracted to very driving, rhythmic music that has overt links to the blues. I mean, if you hear what he's doing there, if you played it on an electric guitar, it could be heavy metal. And Bob is the link between folk and rock and roll.
And Bob Dylan is the one, at least at this stage in his career, writing very political lyrics. But from what I gathered from looking at their lives, really, in her life, Joan Baez is more of the political animal.
That's right. She was more of a political animal, but because she came, you know, Joan and Bob came together at the cusp of two kinds of music, and Joan was an interpretive artist, and Bob was an expressive artist. Joan was not yet composing. She only began composing years later through Dylan's initiative. Dylan encouraged her to begin composing. So even though she was a political animal, inspired mightily by her parents, who were Quakers and political activists, her father in particular, who was a physicist who had been lured into the nuclear program, but then withdrew from participating in it on grounds of principle. Joan was politically oriented, but she wasn't a writer. So she was at a point in the early 60s where her heart was in social activism, but there was very little music like that for her to sing. And Dylan was beginning to compose what he would call finger-pointing songs, which really didn't point fingers that much. They raised questions without giving many answers as a rule, and they were sort of largely poetic in their exploration of social and political themes. And that they came together, and Joan, how does that work out now? Let's see. Bob found a voice for his music, and Joan found a body of work that expressed the latent feelings that she had, and they came together as a perfect combination for a very brief and sort of miraculous time.
I want to introduce the other two figures in the book, especially now because they're not as well known today. But at that time, in the midst of the folk music revival, what would you say was the stature of Richard and Mimi Farinha as performers?
Well, their stature was never comparable. They were never as well known, and they were never as great, and not remotely. I mean, Farinha is not remotely as significant as a composer, as a musician, as Dylan is, but that's why they're in the book. They're in the four of them start out with the same kind of goals and ambitions and aspirations. They're four talented young people setting out to make it, and within a few years, two of them do beyond anybody's wildest expectations, and two don't. So the book then explores what goes into success in this culture. Now, that said, I believe strongly that Richard Farinha should not be a forgotten figure, that there was great prescience in his music. He was way ahead of his time. Andy was genuinely gifted. I think that the music that Richard and Mimi Farina made endures. It should not be forgotten.
Well,
but my intent was to never put them on the same plane as Joan and Bob.
Well, let's listen to a bit of Richard and Mimi Farina, and this is a little bit of the song "Pack Up Your Sorrows."
No use crying, talking to a stranger, naming the sorrow you've seen. Too many bad times, too many sad times, and nobody knows what you mean. Ah, but if somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me, you would lose them. I know how to use them. Give them all to me. And there's no use rambling, dreaming in the darkness, seeking out a satisfied mind. Too many wrong times, too many long times, and nobody's walking behind. Ah, but if somehow you could pack up your sorrows.
And that's "Pack Up Your Sorrows." And I noticed as I read your book, I realized that I was already familiar with, I would say, two or four Richard Farina songs. Mm-hmm. It is simply that I was not familiar mm-hmm. with his recordings of those. Familiar with "Pack Up Your Sorrows" as Joan Baez sang it. I knew other songs because Pete Seeger and Judy Collins had recorded them.
Sure. Well, if you went to summer camp, you heard "Pack Up Your Sorrows" at some point, probably. And Farina also wrote an extraordinary humorous song, and it was extraordinary by the very fact that it was humorous in the 1960s, when so much music was almost stridently serious and sometimes self-righteous. A piece called "Hard Love and Loser" that Judy Collins did on "In My Life," which is one of the classic records of all time. Of
and
course.
Yes, that's one of the songs I remember exactly.
Yeah.
He was, and I should note that is of these four is Richard Farina, who is no longer alive because of his death in the mid-1960s. But he was a very effective lyricist.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to compare him with Bob Dylan, which might not quite be fair, I would say that he might not be inspired in quite the same way, but his technical skills were very strong, and he knew how to put his message together.
Well, he was a published poet and short story writer and a serious literary figure when Dylan was still Bob Zimmerman in Minnesota. He doesn't have Dylan's gift, but he had extraordinary ideas. A boundlessly creative person, and one of his ideas was to combine folk and rock into something he was calling boogie poetry, which you could call folk rock, and that he actually experimented with a couple months before Dylan went into the studio and did "Bringing It All Back Home." Now, that doesn't make it more important or better than "Bringing It All Back Home," but I'm a historian, and it's significant that it was first. It's like saying, let's think of an example, like Rocket. Is it Rocket 88, which is usually considered the first rock and roll song? It's an Ike Turner song. It's not more important than Blue Suede Shoes or Heartbreak Hotel, but it was first. And Farina also had the notion to combine influences from various other cultures in this combination of folk and rock. He brought in Middle Eastern elements and Afro-Cuban elements. He was half Cuban himself. His music is very rhythmic.
Along with
legitimate poetry. So, I mean, it's something to contend with.
Was he a writer first or a folk singer first?
He was a folk singer. He was a writer first. I mean, he was a writer studied under Nabokov at Cornell. His goal was something akin to what Dylan was trying to do, but not exactly the same thing, but related. Farina's notion was to do a kind of rock and roll literature originally. I mean, he was writing short stories and a novel that he worked on for many years, finally published in 1966, called "Been Down So Long, Looks Like Up to Me." It was an attempt at doing literature with a rock and roll attitude, with a rock and roll sensibility. A little bit before, you know, Dylan set out to do popular music and rock and roll with a literary sensibility, kind of a literary rock and roll. So the two men were kind of bookends.
We're talking with David Hadu. He is the author of Positively Fourth Street, The Lives and Times of Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Mimi Baez, Farina, and Richard Farina. It's a new book published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux out of New York, and it is about those four figures during the early 1960s. We're talking here in the Afternoon Magazine, and if you have any questions or comments you'd like to call in with, feel free. Our number is 333-9455, or you can call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Richard Farina, David, was a pretty extroverted guy. I think at one point in your book you said that a lot of people's mental, the caption to their mental picture for Richard Farina was, "Soon there was a party."
Yeah, that's right. Well, he's just about the most colorful figure I've ever encountered in fiction or nonfiction. And in Farina's case, there was frequently little distinction between fiction and nonfiction. He was kind of a creation of his own imagination, as Dylan was to some degree. But Farina was a lot more playful in his spinning yarns and his self-aggrandizing. He used to claim that he ran guns for Castro at one point, and that he was involved with the IRA. In fact, he used to say that he needed to sleep with a loaded .45 under his pillow for fear of retaliation from British authorities for his role in sinking an English submarine.
Why did he say all this, which I gather isn't quite exactly true?
Well, there were germs of truth to all of it, but not much more than that. Oh, he just tried to make himself a romantic, exotic, mysterious figure, kind of a Heathcliff figure. Mm-hmm. Somebody who went to college with him said that Richard Farina seemed like he was born wearing a cape, you know. And there was always, in Farina's case, a kind of a self-awareness of this grand charade that made it not only palatable but kind of fun to the people he was with. There was always he did it all with a wink, you know, that, oh, come on, life is just a grand game, let's have fun. And that, I think, was refreshing to many people in an era that was imbued with a kind of self-conscious seriousness. You know, Richard was probably the most fun of anybody in that whole scene. I don't know what else I can add to that.
Well, we have a caller coming in, and I wonder if we can take a break here to talk to line one over in Champaign. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. You mentioned that Richard's no longer living, but he died in 66 or 67. I think 66.
Yeah, April 30th, 1966.
Yeah, and so I don't know if it's really fair to compare him to people who have had 40 years to develop their careers.
That's right. That's a very good point. I mean, he did, if I could interject here for a second, he only did two albums with Mimi, and nearly half the songs on those two records were instrumentals. So his entire body of songs is just a handful of songs, and the fact that we can talk about five or six of them as enduring is really a remarkable record, and there's no one else with a record quite like that, with the exception of Dylan, really, because of Dylan's first two records, the second record was so great. That's a good point. Were you a fan at the time?
Well, no, I found out about him. I happened to be out in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, in Berkeley, for a trip in 1966, and it was that summer, and he had already died. But then I was introduced to his novel, Been Down So Long Looks Like Up to Me. Are you familiar with it?
I sure am, yeah.
And
it figures quite
hilarious.
Prominently in my book.
What?
It figures prominently in my book.
Okay, it's a hilarious book. You know, it's a very funny, sort of darkly funny novel.
Oh, there's no question about it that the book is real literature. I mean, it's a first novel. It's flawed. It's a little indulgent. It's a period piece, but it's an evocative period piece and quite a wild one.
It's something I'm interested in here is really the recordings of Varinia are still in print. I think Vanguard Records has kept them in print. And as you note in your book, his novel is still in print, which is doing pretty well for someone who hasn't been able to nurture his reputation the way Bob Dylan has for the last 35 years.
Leonard Cohen wrote how many books? A lot of people who had one foot in music and one foot in the world of literature dabbled in literature, including Dylan with Tarantula, and all those books are most of those books are out of print. Varinia's is a Penguin classic. It's still not only in print, but it's taught at the university level.
One
book, and it's still taught. That's really a testament to the thing's value.
That's the novel still being
yes.
taught?
Yes.
Wow. What I wonder about, though, is that Mimi, now, did you mention that Mimi and Joan were sisters?
Not yet.
And I'm sorry if I haven't made that clear. Mimi was the youngest sister. Joan was the middle sister
right.
of the Baez family.
Right.
Right.
There was a third sister, Pauline, who is a recluse, still lives to this day in a literally in a treehouse. Literally
in a treehouse.
So the book is largely about these two women, the two Baez sisters, and their men.
Uh-huh.
So
well,
you were saying about that, about Mimi?
Well, I just wonder that she didn't answer on the speakerphone. That she didn't do much with her career after Richard died.
You know, Mimi, it's funny you should say that because she has done more with her career than Joan or virtually any of her peers, with the possible exception of Dylan. She abandoned public performing after Richard died. She tried to team up with another singer in the 70s, a guy by the name of Tom Jans. But aside from that, she abandoned public performing in favor of public service. And she founded an organization for 35 years ago, something like that, maybe 40 years ago. No, 30 years ago, forgive me, called Bread and Roses, that brings music and entertainment to shut-ins. And it was the first organization of its kind, founded in the Bay Area. And it sets up over 400 performances a year that go to hospices and hospitals and even prisons. And there are now branch organizations and sister organizations all around the country. And Mimi started it, was the founding president of it, and ran it for the last 30 years.
Wow.
So she's had a very important and busy career, but off the entertainment radar.
Yeah, I guess she's not famous like Joan.
No, it should be.
Yeah. Oh well, that's still
for
very
that.
Interesting.
I mean, she shouldn't be famous, but she should be recognized for doing great work for the last 30 years. Unfortunately, she's quite ill at the moment.
Yes,
tragically,
and that is something I came across. Notice going over some of the artists' websites at this point. Joan Baez, who is still quite active, turned 60 in January, has called off most of her touring because she wants to spend more time with her sister, who's in a battle with cancer.
That's right. She's with Mimi at the moment. Mimi's fighting cancer valiantly. It's interesting that Joan's 60th birthday came and went earlier this year with virtually no acknowledgement in the press, and that the entertainment world seemed to stop for Bob when he reached his 60th.
Well, It's also interesting. A point is, although that that Mimi Baez did marry again after Richard Farina's death, mm-hmm. Married and divorced a few years later, it is Richard Farina's name that she has kept, mm-hmm. at least as her public surname.
Yeah, well, that's true. I think that by being a Farina, she avoids being a Baez, and of course avoids constant comparisons to her sister. It's a way of her retaining an identity apart from her sister. And it was difficult for Mimi coming up as a talented musician pursuing a field where, you know, where a sibling rivalry is bad enough in any event, but when your older sister happens to be the most popular singer in the world, you know, it compounds the problem rather dramatically.
David Haidu, we were talking a little bit earlier about the personality and persona of Richard Farina and the image he nurtured. Bob Dylan was also nurturing an image at this time, wasn't he?
He sure was. And it was his second one, which I think is very little known. I mean, Robert Zimmerman created a fictitious persona when he first went into music, but it wasn't Bob Dylan. It was a creation called Elston Gunn. It was a rock and roll character, and he wore pink shirts and bow ties, and he played rock and roll piano as this character, Elston Gunn. He got the name from Peter Gunn, which was the most popular TV show, one of the most popular TV shows that season. And when rock and roll started to fade and folk emerged as the new pop music, Dylan abandoned his first persona, remade himself, and took another name from a TV star, TV character, Matt Dillon from Gunsmoke, and changed his wardrobe, changed his name, moved east, and as a new creation, as Bob Dylan.
Folk music was not his first love?
No. It was originally an R&B rock and roll piano player.
So
had a whole handful of bands when he was in high school.
So when Bob Dylan went electric in the mid-1960s and caused a large amount of controversy among his folk music followers, it was not so much a departure as perhaps a return.
That's right. He signaled that with the first album where he played rock and roll, called Bringing It All Back Home. It was going home for him. It wasn't going somewhere new. It was coming home, you know, without any question. But, you know, I should point out that the folk purists were already quite enraged with Dylan for about a year before he started playing amplified, you know, rock-oriented kind of music, because he had abandoned largely abandoned political content. He did an album before Bringing It All Back Home called Another Side of Bob Dylan that were personal songs and poetic songs and songs that dealt with his life and his relationships and his feelings. And that infuriated the folk cognoscenti. I mean, absolutely enraged them. There were diatribes in magazines like Sing Out for Bob, you know, supposedly abandoning his principles, for daring to write about himself rather than the world. And that... that was a year before Newport, 65, when he went electric.
We have a caller on from Chicago calling in. Line 4 from Chicago, good afternoon. You're on the air.
Thank you. Very colorful program. Was there any interaction or cross-pollination between, say, Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and others, the Beat group that were with Bob and Joan and others?
There was quite a bit of... cross-pollination between the Beats and Farina. Now, Farina was influenced by the Beats, but he took them with a grain of salt and wrote some satiric parodies of Beat poetry early in his literary career. Now, then Farina was an early literary influence on Dylan when they were both young and unknown and starting out in the Village. A little bit later, Ginsberg and Dylan met and became friends. They became quite close, in fact. And as I understand from reading Ginsberg's accounts, he was quite an influence on Dylan. He exposed Dylan to not works of not only the Beats but other poets, and I think gave him some writing tips. I think he critiqued some of his work.
Yeah, he certainly opened up the eyes of a lot of things, and I'm glad you commented on all the things you have. Thank you very much. I'll look forward to your book.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. We want to say hello to another listener, Line 1 from Terre Haute, Indiana. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Very interesting program. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Richard Farina's death, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Hmm. How did Richard Farina pass away?
Well, I don't want to go into too much detail because it's the ending of the book, and I don't want to ruin it for the people who... I don't completely ruin the experience of the story, reading of the book. But the essence of it is that Farina and Dylan were in a kind of a race to prove who was the more serious literary figure, and they were both due to have their books published in 1966. Farina's was published first, and he had one book signing party on April 30th, 1966. It happened to be his wife's 21st birthday. There's a little bit more to the story because this was not only Mimi's 21st, she's 21, it's not only her legal coming of age, a legal age of emancipation, it turned out being her literal emancipation in every way because after his one and only book signing party, upon publication of his one and only book, Farina died in a motorcycle accident. The details are harrowing and tragic, but that's the essence of it.
Mm-hmm. This occurred in the same year as the Bob Dylan's motorcycle accident.
It occurred 60 days prior to that, to the day, and I don't think that's an accident. I don't think that Dylan's accident was... I think that Dylan's state was rather serious, and he was in a life-threatening state owing to the rigors of his schedule, his involvement with drugs at the time. I don't think there's any question that the so-called accident was not terribly serious, but that he used it as an excuse, not an excuse, rather, a reason to slow down, to regroup. This accident saved his life. And Bob said to Joan, years after the two accidents, that Farina's accident really made him think. And it leads one to wonder how much his seeing what had happened to his friend Farina, how much that had led him to maybe deal with his own mortality. And maybe that was his impetus to slow down. But anyway, there's a little more about that in the book, too.
I'm going to squeeze in just one more call before we're out of time.
Okay.
Line 2 from Urbana. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yeah, unfortunately, I had to miss most of this, but I was wondering, I happened to see this little bio thing on Joan Baez, Where Are They Now kind of thing, while I was working out, and it said that she was on a ranch and pretty much stayed there all the time. And I don't know if that was accurate or not, but I was just that made me wonder if, from what I did catch of this interview, financially, was she okay, through most of her life, or did she have to depend on friends and such, or what?
Joan has always made a nice living. She was commanding top figures as a concert attraction in the early 60s, but she has certainly never given up recording or performing. She maintains a modest schedule by choice. She could take more dates, but she only tours for the total of a few months out of the year. She's very active. I just saw her at Carnegie Hall last fall. She just recorded a couple of years ago, and she's not active at the moment because she's at her sister's side, but she's not living on a ranch by any stretch of the imagination. She has a nice home in Northern California near the Silicon Valley. And her mother lives with her now. She's still a vital recording and performing artist.
And I think I'm going to have to break off there on this fascinating subject. Unfortunately, we're all out of time, and I'm sorry that we can't take the last caller waiting.
Yeah.
But David Haidu, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us. It's your new book is called Positively Fourth Street, named after a Bob Dylan song. The Lives and Times of Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Mimi Baez Farinha, and Richard Farinha, just published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And David, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I had a wonderful time.